Phoebe is going to the White House today, and he's going to be speaking with President Obama. What will they be talking about? The flotilla or a possible next war? And how to prepare for that? Will it involve Iran? Will it involve Israel? Will it involve the whole world? Well, we have with us today Edwin Black. He is a prolific author. He also writes for the cuttingedgenews.com website. And you can check out his own website at edwinblack.com. Edwin Black is an award-winning New York Times best-selling and international investigative author of 69 award-winning editions in 14 languages in 61 countries. He has written it for scores of newspapers and magazines, and he's been nominated for several awards. He is the author of several books, some of them called The IBM and the Holocaust, The Transfer Agreement, War Against the Weak, Banking on Baghdad, The Nazi Nexus, and his newest book out now called The Farhud, The Arab Nazi Alliance in the Holocaust. Welcome to the show, Edwin Black.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Tamar.
It's very, very good to have you on. I love investigative reporters. You guys have a lot of testosterone, so good for you to really go out there and put your neck out. So tell us, you know, right now there's so much going on in the news, especially with Israel, and then there's the BP oil spill, which is creating a lot of havoc on the international scene, not just on the American scene. And how does all of this with the flotilla and Israel, Iran, the whole nexus of what's going on in the world today, even some leftover, perhaps, Nazism from World War II emerging today with communism, all of these things rearing their ugly heads in a time of weakness for the superpower America?
Well, you've mentioned a lot of topics, a lot of newsworthy topics. They're all over the board, and they would appear to be completely unrelated. But the fact is they're all related. They're all related to one central issue, and they have been since the beginning of the history of these topics, and they will continue to moving forward. The one common issue is oil. It is oil that has gotten the world into this petro-political mess. It's oil that keeps us in this mess, and it's oil which will determine what we do and don't do in the months and years to come with respect to the world, to the United States, and Israel. Mm-hmm. Well, why don't we take them one at a time? First of all, we should talk about British Petroleum. I'm actually just writing those chapters now for my next book, The Farhud, which is actually coming out in a couple of months. And British Petroleum was actually originally known as Anglo-Persian Oil Company, and the invasion of Iraq in 1914 and the creation of Iraq was done by, for, and with the cooperation of, and according to the instructions of, Anglo-Persian, which later changed its name to Anglo-Iranian, and after they were booted out of Iran, changed their name to British Petroleum. Hmm. It is oil and the discovery of oil in the Middle East, primarily through Anglo-Persian and British Petroleum and the secret red line agreement that gave the West a monopoly on Mideast oil after World War I, that put the world at the beck and call of the Arab world when it came time to petroleum dependency. That's how we got to where we are. That's how the Arab world became empowered. That is why there have been so many wars in the area. And oil money is not only funding terrorism, oil money is funding Iran. Their major crop is not corn, it's not wheat, it's oil. And every time one of us drives to the corner, we are funding the Iranian nuclear effort on the mileage program. Every dollar we give to Iran somehow goes into feeding Iran's ability to buy its technology from either North Korea or from Geneva or from all the different places, and now it's becoming autarkic, which means it can develop its own. It gets Korean missiles, which are Nodong missiles, and renames them Shahab missiles. This is all being driven by oil. And, in fact, it's oil that is driving, that is the placemat, if you will, for Bibi Netanyahu's meeting with Barack Obama. Why does America care about the Middle East? Why does America care about peace between Israel and its Arab neighbors and the Palestinian territories? Once again, it's oil peace. It's not social peace. It's not international peace. It's oil peace. And so we need to understand that while your question originally appeared to be all over the board, that board was nailed, riveted to one central issue, and that issue is oil.
Wow, I didn't even know I asked such a great question. Okay, good. So explain to me again, because I wasn't quite following. So BP Oil, is there still a connection with Iran in the sense of who owns the company or who has power there?
The British government controlled the company until about a generation ago. The British government funded Anglo-Persian as an arm of British foreign policy in oil and oil imperialism. Originally, in 1901, Anglo-Persian secured an oil concession from the Shah of Iran. The first oil was obtained in 1908 from a gusher, and they always knew that that gusher and the rich oil fields below the land would extend across the map marks, which demarcated Mesopotamia, which became Iraq. And in World War I, just days after the war was ignited with Germany, Britain used that as used the war as a pretext to invade Turkish Mesopotamia. They secured the oil fields, and they actually created the nation of Iraq for, by, and with Anglo-Persian deciding exactly what parts of Turkish territory, of Mesopotamian territory, of Basra, of Baghdad, and Mosul would be included in the country to be, and that country to be was named Iraq. About a generation ago, the British government divested itself of its 51% share, or whatever share it had in the company, and its ability to control what foreign policy and military policy areas the company was engaged in. I'm actually writing about this right now, and that will be in my next book, The Farhood, and then the book after that will be called British Petroleum and the Red Line Agreement. But that won't come out until after this interview and next year.
Okay. So, in other words, when America is dealing with BP, with British Petroleum, who's making the money in British Petroleum? Where is it going? Is it going into Britain or is it going into Iran or where?
Right now, the money of British Petroleum is going into the coffers of the company. When you say the company, you are talking about the stockholders. The day of the British government retaining shares of the company are now over, but the company became wealthy. The company became the company that we know through its warmongering posture in the world, in which its destiny, its function, its purpose, and its authority was created by an international consortium for the sole purpose of conquering and exploiting the oil in Arab lands.
Okay, so who are the other stockholders besides the British?
You and me.
You and me? I am?
Well, actually, you, not me.
Me?
Probably you.
How is that?
And you might not even know that you're invested. If you have any money invested in any fund anywhere, whether it's retirement fund, 501k, a 401k, if you are part of a teacher's union with a retirement fund, if you're in a money management fund, the chances are that your money is in somebody's British Petroleum investment instruments. But the fact of the matter, British Petroleum, which now says it does not want more government intervention, has thrived on government intervention. It was created by government intervention. Its purpose in life was to be an intervener on behalf of government, and it intervened in other governments. It usually selected who was the more powerful government to intervene for, and that power was generally Britain. But its footprint is all over the culture, the history, the economic realms of Iran, of Iraq, of Turkey, of Mosul, and many other areas. And now it's come to the Gulf. And by coming into the Gulf, which it's been here for a long time, because remember, it wasn't born yesterday, it was born as a war machine. This war machine has now washed all of its war profits into straight commercial profits, and those commercial profits are now recklessly in the Gulf of Mexico. They had sweetheart deals, sweetheart regulation, lobbyists, etc. They had the United States government in eating out of its hand. The Bush administration was not regulating it properly. When Obama came to power, there was no change. And for a year and a half, the same posture was in place. And once again, the company was not regulated. They were allowed to have fatal industrial accidents. They were allowed to have allowed to rack up some 97% of all the OSHA complaints. They fought every fine and penalty, tooth and nail. And now, I assure you, for over a generation, the hell that they have wrought in the Gulf of Mexico will be with us. Even if they clean off the surface, they have now dispersed this petroleum throughout the bottom, through the mid-strata. If you go to Prince William Sound in Alaska and you see the most pristine postcards with trees and lakes, you stick your hand into the oil, into the ground, and out comes a handful of sand laced with petroleum goo. You go down a few feet in a scuba dive, and you find out that this pristine water, what looks like a postcard, has actually got full ledges of oil and petroleum. It took 3 million years to make the oil that has been consumed by the United States in just a short period of time. Oil is a geologic process that takes millions of years. Oil and water do not mix. This oil will be with the Gulf, with the west coast of Florida, with Fort Lauderdale, with North Carolina. It will go into the world for the years to come. We haven't even begun to see the damage and danger coming from this completely unregulated disaster. This, to me, was criminal negligence, and the criminal negligence was done on behalf of the company. It was done by the regulators. They always knew that if they kept lighting fires in a turpentine factory, that it would ultimately explode. This is criminal negligence. And what I expect to see now is I expect a very quiet, rapid-fire process by which British Petroleum will transfer its viable assets out of the company into safe harbor entities, so that when the British Petroleum, we now know, is forced to pay everything it must, they will go bankrupt, and what will be left will be like we had in Detroit, the good GM and the bad GM. You will see it soon.
Let me ask you this question. You were talking about oil and water mix, that they don't mix. What about the mix between Obama and BP and the Middle East, specifically Israel. We know that anything that has to do with oil, they're always going to take the Arab side because that's where the oil is coming from right now. So how is Israel a victim to this oil interest? And since Obama and Netanyahu are going to be meeting tomorrow, or today actually, in the White House Tuesday, what do you see happening with these dynamics?
That is a two-part question with a two-part or a multi-part answer. What does Obama have to do with oil? The first thing is he has killed or subordinated or shunted to the side alternative energy. We're talking about electric cars. We're talking about hydrogen cars, natural gas cars. So all this has done is just increased our reliance on petroleum products. So we are more and more determined and desperate to be hooked on Mideast oil. Even Cash for Clunkers was a program by which we condemned the next generation of Americans, children who were just getting out of grammar school, to drive on petroleum cars. So that's the A. The B is, what is the relationship? How do you balance the relationship of the desperate need to retain the oil connection with the desperate need to avoid a disruption in that connection by Israel attacking Iran over its nuclear program, or a preemptive closure of the Strait of Hormuz? Closing the Strait of Hormuz would disrupt 40% of the world's seaborne oil, some 20% of the global supply, some 20% or more of America's supply. We only have a 57-day emergency stockpile, the SPG, the Strategic Petroleum. We only have 57 days of that. And those and that 57-day supply is unrefined. There's no plan for an oil interruption. It's not being discussed. Obama's not discussing it. Schwarzenegger is not discussing it. Florida's not discussing it. Republicans are not discussing it. And Democrats are not discussing it. And as a result of the nation completely not discussing this pending and promised disaster, which is being promised to us every day by the president of Iran. As a result of this, we are even more vulnerable to the political processes in the Middle East. That said, I think you're going to see a brand new and different appearance at the next meeting of Obama and Netanyahu. Last time he was insulted. Last time he was shunted to the side. I'm not sure whether he was given a bottle of water or not given a bottle of water. That's in dispute. This time, all the atmospherics will be there. The optics will be there. The president is going to have a joint press conference with Bibi. Mrs. Obama will be inviting the prime minister's wife, Sarah, to some special festivities. There will be a joint statement at the end. There will be a lavish lunch. There will be a lavish luncheon, and I think the atmospherics will be right to possibly reinforce Israel's belief that it needs a strong United States ally. If it gets that, then there could be a little better temperature in the room for the very, very hot topics that are going to be discussed. And those discussions are going to be settlements. They're going to be sanctions. They're going to be a potential military attack on Iran. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff has been to Israel since Obama took over, I believe, 13 or possibly 16 times. Either that's close coordination military with Israel, or constant efforts to make sure that Israel does not go ahead and launch its own attack. Other things are going to be on the table. It is very possible that Netanyahu will now feel sufficiently reassured that he will be able to announce that, yes, he will accept a independent Palestinian state within the two-year time frame that's been enunciated. It is possible that there will be a straight final solution, a final status, or maybe another attempt at an incremental status, which was done with Egypt, which was done with Sinai, which is done with other places. All of this remains to be seen, but this much we know, there will be a much more conducive atmosphere to the discussions which are about to take place.
And why this change of heart with how Obama will be treating Netanyahu as opposed to the other times? What is in it for Obama?
There's nothing in it for Obama. The United States Congress actually has a vote in this matter, and the United States Congress has supported Israel. They've supported Israel over the flotilla issue, the United States, which was a complete provocation by Turkey. They have supported, they have demanded that the Obama administration stand with Israel, and there's been a lot of noise in the background preceding this meeting. As you know, this meeting was canceled at the last moment because of the flotilla crisis, and this time they want to do it right. It's become painfully obvious that if you're the president of Lebanon, you get a state dinner, and if you're the prime minister of Israel, you seem to get a box lunch. They want to put that. In fact, he didn't even get the box lunch. They want to put that aside, and they want to try to have enough proper optics so that this will not only play in the Middle East, but it'll play correctly for the midterm elections, because a lot of the Jewish voters in the key voting districts in Florida, New York, Texas, California are now completely reversed. They've become the polls have reversed, and they're now not interested in voting with the Obama Party, with the Democrats. They would like to address that. So there are political considerations, and it's very clear that Netanyahu himself cannot sell the hard concessions to the Israeli public unless he can be seen as being strong, he can be seen on parity, and he can be seen with a modicum of Derek Eretz, which means, for those of us who don't speak the language, a modicum of decent respect.
Very good translation. All right, we are speaking with Edwin Black, thecuttingedgenews.com and edwinblack.com. Those are the websites to check out during the break. We're going to be back and talk more about the whole connection between Obama, Netanyahu, Israel, the United States, Turkey, the flotilla, and all the politics that are going on today, as well, of course, as oil, when we get back.
You just pray for them.
Israel National Radio.
Israel National Radio.
You're listening to Israel National Radio.
Israel National Radio.
I say a little prayer for you.
Israel National Radio.
Israel National Radio. We're praying for redemption.
Kiddushta, the personal touch, invite everyone to their two exciting stores, one in the heart of Jerusalem and one in Modi'im. Kiddushta, the personal touch, is the epitome of elegant style and service. Sterling silver, artistic glassware, jewelry, talitot, mezuzot, and much more. And also features a full boutique wine department specializing in Israeli wines. And, of course, everything is available online at Judaica4U, Judaica, the numeral 4 and the letter U.com.
The Tamar Yonah Show.
Courage.
Thus saith the Lord God of Israel, let my people go.
Audacity.
Anu makrizim bazot al hakamat medina yudit li eretz Yisrael, li medinat Yisrael.
History. Miracles.
No more bloodshed. Shalom. Salam. Forever.
Israel.
Broadcasting from Bethel, just north of Jerusalem, D.C. That's right. Jerusalem, David's capital. King David's capital.
King David's capital.
King David's capital. And now, Tamar Yonah.
Bibi is going to be meeting with Obama today in the White House. So what is going to go on there? What will they discuss? Will it be about the flotilla, about blockades, about the Turkish relations, about an upcoming war? What will they be talking about? We have with us as our guest today, Edwin Black. He's an investigative reporter and author of several books. He's an award-winning writer as well. Some of his books to check out, IBM and the Holocaust, The War Against the Weak, Banking on Baghdad, The Nazi Nexus, and a new book that will be coming out very soon called The Farhud, The Arab-Nazi Alliance in the Holocaust. Welcome back to the show, Edwin Black.
And thank you again for having me.
Everybody is wondering what's going to be with our prime minister, if he's going to hold strong. We are all waiting here, who are living in Judea and Samaria, to see that the building freeze that Obama had requested from our prime minister be taken off and that we be able to continue building here, which we need to do because we're choking. We are suspicious that Obama is going to want to force an additional longer-term building freeze, and that this is going to go nowhere, and that our prime minister will crumble to the pressure that he's under. So what are your thoughts about this, and what do you think is the right thing for our prime minister to do?
Well, I can't advise your prime minister, but I can opine about the perspectives on this matter. First of all, I do believe that President Obama is going to pressure further Bibi Netanyahu to extend, prolong, and widen the freeze. This is not being run by anyone other than General Jones at the National Security Council. And General Jones has an understanding that the Arab side of this equation will be happy to engage in peace when they get what they want. And what they really want is they want a Palestinian state that goes right up to the bagel vendors outside the old city. And at that point, they will make peace. Historically, there has been no peace in the Holy Land between Arabs and Jews, and it's not as much for territorial reasons as simply religious reasons. Now, let's look at some of the facts about who are the Israelis. Half the Israelis are of Arab extraction. They're Moroccans, they're Libyans, they're Syrians, they're Iraqis. They happen to be of Arab extraction, but a different religion. And I believe you must not diminish the importance of dhimmitude and the compulsion to observe dhimmi status in the relationship between the Arabs and the Jews. Naturally, when the Arabs put their foot on a piece of land, that land automatically is a candidate for the caliphate. And so the question of whether a peaceful, independent Gaza would be established by the Israelis picking up and leaving it has already been answered. I believe that the real settlement freeze that the Arabs want is not one that stops at the old city. I think they would like it to stop at the Mediterranean. And I think they would not only want the Jews out of those parts of East Jerusalem, I think they might also want them out of Haifa, they might want them out of Tel Aviv, they might want them out of Nahariya, just all sorts of places. So these are the historical underpinnings. Now, does the Obama administration understand this? Probably not. Does General Jones understand this? Probably not. I don't believe they have an understanding of the Jewish majority that was in Jerusalem for centuries. I don't think they have an understanding of the fact that even when Yemenite Jews under Turkish control emigrated to Palestine, in the 19th century, they were also reviled by the Turkish, by the Turks. They were also reviled by the Arab indigenous population. In fact, I don't believe that the Obama administration understands that the word Palestinian for many, many decades meant one thing, a Jewish Zionist, the Jewish Agency for Palestine, the Palestine Post, all of these different common usages in the newspapers of the day, in the diplomacy of the day, in the common parlance of the day, defined a Palestinian as one, as a Jew who was a Zionist who wanted to settle in the Holy Land. They don't understand this, but what they do think is that they can buy peace by this methodology of pressuring Israel. This does not address whether Israel should not go way out on a limb for peace. I personally would like to see them go as far out on a limb as possible for peace, as long as the limb does not break off. Now, the limb has not broken off with Egypt. The limb thus far has not broken off with Jordan. Certainly, it's a cold peace with Egypt. It's a cold peace with Jordan. But I'm just not sure if they can actually achieve the same with Jordan and Egypt, if they can achieve that same status right next door when their Arab antagonists are not across the desert, not across the river, but across the street.
Hmm. Well, you know what? I would actually call this not a peace with Egypt and Jordan, but more of like a ceasefire. And I would imagine that both of these countries would be or take part in an upcoming war against Israel when all the Arabs come in for the slaughter. But tell us about where Turkey comes in, because you mentioned that the Ottoman Empire, Turkey is all of a sudden moving over to the Eastern Hemisphere. Before they wanted to be accepted into the European Union. They were rejected. Now they're kind of like flirting with Iran and the Eastern Hemisphere. Where does all of this come in?
They're not flirting with Iran. They're in bed with Iran. That's not flirting.
Okay.
Yeah. Turkey has been blackmailing Israel and in the international Jewish community for well over a century. They blackmailed Herzl continuously in order to allow Herzl to save the Jews and find an exit route for them during the late 19th century after the pogroms in Russia. The money was never enough. They always wanted to steal money from the Jews and give them nothing. They interfered with the potential of Germany helping out, and Turkey has always been engaged in this kind of blackmail. Turkey talks about a humanitarian flotilla. Turkey right now is a country that has continuously been extorting in the 21st century the civilized countries of the world to not use the G word, genocide, with respect to the mass murder, the organized, systematic mass murder of 1.3 to 1.5 million Armenians. Mm-hmm. And this is the country that says it is a humanitarian country. This is a nation. This is an empire. This is a legacy which going all the way back to the 19th century, and I think you'll read this in my next book, The Farhud. You'll have to wait till the fall. This is a country that drew a fine line. It allowed in the British. It allowed in the Spanish. It allowed in Moroccans. It allowed in Libyans. But it would not allow Jews to come into Palestine, which was their own country. Remember, please, that the name Palestine was given to the land of Israel by the Romans as part and parcel of their expulsion of the Jews, and it was to erase the identity of the Jewish kingdom that the Romans renamed it Syria Palestina.
Mm-hmm, right. Farhud was a pogrom against the Jews that took place in Baghdad in Iraq.
The Farhud, which was originally written by me in my prior book, Banking on Baghdad, was the June 1941 Nazi pogrom, part of an alliance that the Arab world had with the Nazis. It was in Baghdad. It was as vicious and horrible as the Kishinev pogrom. Many Jews were slaughtered. They were sliced up. The babies were decapitated and bashed to bits. But this was part and parcel of an international Baghdad to Bosnia to Beersheba axis between the Arabs and the Nazis. You know, the Arabs are very fond of saying, why are we in Palestine having to be involved in this European crisis, this European Holocaust? What do we have to do with that? They have everything to do with that. They were shoulder to shoulder with the Nazis from the very first moment that Hitler came to power on January 30th, 1933. They were diplomatically in league. They were fighting in the trenches with the Arab and Islamic SS divisions. And you might ask yourself a question. Did all those Nazi trucks run on cotton? Did they run on wood? They ran on oil. How did Moshe Dayan lose his eye? He lost his eye in an operation to stop the oil from going to the Nazis. He was in Lebanon. So anyway, this is part and parcel of my book. And instead of writing a book just about this one pogrom with all the bloodshed and all the violence and trying to evoke the passion of my readers, I'm giving the long haul. I'm talking about the 2,600-year existence of the Jews in Iraq. I'm talking about the 1,000-year existence in Israel. I am talking about the interaction over centuries between the European powers, oil, the Jews, the Ottoman Empire, World War One, the Balfour Declaration, how all of these things come into play before Hitler comes to power, and then Hitler does come to power, and the Mufti of Jerusalem, not acting alone in a basement, but as part of an international consortium of Muslim and Arab higher command, cultivate a complete international alliance with the Nazis, and they do this for the sole purpose of destroying the Jews, destroying the British presence in the Middle East, and attempting to get the same type of caliphate independence that they had sought from the days of Faisal and Hussein. The theory was, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and even though the Nazis were a horrible infidel that hated the Arabs, the Arab says it does not matter. We will make a common cause with them in the same way that we made common cause with Britain in 1914 when we went against the Turks.
All right. We have Nazism in the picture here. Why is it, do you think, that the world hates the Jews so much? We've got Obama who can, he could see the truth. He's got an intelligence agency. He can know the Nazi roots with the Arab world. He can know about how Israel is, shares the same values, many of the same values as the Americans do, and yet he is hurting us and bringing up regimes that are totally intolerant to women, to Christians, to Jews, to human rights, and yet he takes their side over the Jews. Why this Jew hatred around the world?
Well, I'm not going to validate whether or not Obama takes their side or one side or the other at this point. But let me address your other question. Why is there such a Jew hatred around the world spanning centuries? And there's a couple of different responses. The first response is that after the Jews were expelled by the Romans from their home in Israel, they became the outsiders. And they were not only expelled by the Romans, they were expelled in 1491 and 1492 by the Spanish. They were expelled by the French. They were expelled by the British. There were many expulsions. So right. The Jews were always the outsider. They were never the guys who lived on the next farm. They were never the guys who lived on the next valley. They always had to bring with them portable professions. They had to be peddlers. They had to be financiers. They had to be teachers. But they were always the other guy. And it was the in-group, out-group dynamic that made Jews be hated, whether the well was poisoned, whether the Black Plague was engulfing the village. Whatever it was easy to blame the Jews. Now, this, your religion is different than my religion, became a political manifestation by and through Henry Ford in 1919, 1920, 1921, when he took the religious hatred and magnified it to an international Jewish conspiracy, so that there were no good Jews. And this is in my book, Nazi Nexus. There were no good Jews. Whatever was wrong with the Jews, whatever was wrong with the world was part of a Jewish conspiracy to manipulate the money, the militaries, the news, the newspapers and media, the governments using communism.
What about today, though?
What about today?
Yeah.
Well, one of the things you need to understand is that the Nazi campaign to destroy the Jews ended in Europe in May of 1945 and then continued under the tutelage of Nazis in the Arab world. And the Arab disenfranchisement, persecution, and destruction of Jewish communities in Arab lands in the years right after World War II, say from about 1948 right through the 50s, was no longer massacre-oriented. It was now directly along the Eichmann plan. Identify the Jews. Expel them from society. Step three, confiscate their assets. Step four, ghettoize them. And step five, deport them. And step six, instead of extermination, was expulsion from the country. And so what you see, which is what I'm covering in the Farhud, is you see this mass expulsion of the Jews out of Morocco, out of Iraq, out of Libya, out of Egypt, all of these different places, hoping to create a demographic time bomb in Israel, where hundreds of thousands of Jews, actually a million Jews, more or less, would be lined up on the beach. Israel would not know how to deal with them, and that they would do the same thing that the Arab nations have done with their own dispossessed and keep them in camps or let them die on the spot. What did Israel do? They embraced these people. They adjusted them. They absorbed them. They made them part of the culture. And right now, a generation later, the Israeli power structure, the Israeli nation, is substantially influenced by descendants of these original expelled Sephardim and Orientals who were part of this continuing Nazi project to destroy the Jews. That Nazi project to destroy the Jews became entrenched in the Middle East, became entrenched in the Arab world, and has now found common cause with Holocaust deniers. Much of this is funded by the Ford Foundation through philanthropic donations. This was part of an investigation that I did. And now there is a sort of an alliance, if you will, which is a broken line alliance between Holocaust deniers, boycotters, disenfranchisers, disinvestment types, and all these people who want to see Israel delegitimized, see Israel disappear. I'm talking about Holocaust deniers, Jew haters, anti-Zionists, and even to a certain degree, a number of anti-Zionist extreme radical Israelis and those from the Jewish community who have found a comfortable home, whether it's Naturi Karta or other types of people who have found a comfortable home in this alliance against Israel.
Or even the State Department and some in the Barack Obama administration. But, you know,
I'm not responding to that.
I know. All right. We have like about a minute and a half to 2 minutes left. I want to ask you very quickly, back to the Oval Office for a moment. Obama is going to probably put the thumb screws on Netanyahu not to build, and maybe he's going to offer Netanyahu some type of action against Iran. Do you think that's going to happen? What's going to happen, and what should happen?
It's hard to say what is happening with Iran. It's hard to know whether there's going to be a coordinated attack or whether there's not going to be a coordinated attack. Either one could happen at a moment's notice. I think all the players, carry some of the cards. And so I think that Netanyahu will be pressed, and pressed severely, to make concessions because the Obama administration is under the impression that the Arab world will cooperate more with the allies, with the Western nations, in their effort to dissuade Iran if there are strong concessions by Israel. Now, this is a moral parody that I cannot understand. Why the question of adjusting a peace treaty or a border is tantamount to mass murder by Iran, where they will attempt to do in 12 minutes what Hitler could not do in 12 years. Why these things have moral equivalency in the White House, I cannot understand. But I am absolutely certain that there will be pressure on Bibi to do this. Now, whether or not this is going to be, that this will have a positive fruit, it's possible that it will have a positive fruit. After all, Bibi is flying directly to Egypt, I believe. I could be wrong about this, to brief Hosni Mubarak. I'm sure the Saudis are going to be briefed. It's impossible to know whether real progress is being made or it's just setting the stage for another war, another attempt to annihilate the Jews. You have to understand.
You got to sum
up. It's very, very hard to overturn 5,000 years of history, or 3,000 years of history, or 700 years of history.
All right. Well, we'll have to do our best. EdwinBlack.com and TheCuttingEdgeNews.com. You can sign up for his newsletters there as well as at TheCuttingEdgeNews.com. Thank you so much for being with us, Edwin Black. Thank you.
I'll be back.